Welcome back to the Exterminatus Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things competitive in the world of Warhammer 40,000. I'm your host, Eric. With me is my co-host, Ray.
Hello.
Hey, how bad do you want an AMBOT?
I don't know enough about the AMBOT to actually say one way or another yet.
Yeah, I know. It looks really cool, though. I just look at that thing, it's like, that's awesome. I don't know what I'm going to use it for. Like, I could use it as a counts as something, but it just looks awesome.
That it does.
But yeah, I have no idea. I haven't seen any 40K stats for it. They had this little, like, gladiatorial game on the website today, kind of showing it off. I was like, oh, okay. That was kind of neat. Kind of interesting. So absolutely. So yeah, kind of a neat new model there. We got some, you know, some more stragglers and more and more and more hints about whatever this new Vigilus Black Legion stuff is. Getting really excited about this stuff.
I'm starting to get excited too.
So as of this recording, we're like 8.5 days. I think it was 9 days this morning. So
eight days left.
So I'm trying to do the math right. That means, is this being released like midweek?
The announcement will probably be midweek.
I see. Okay. I was trying to figure that out. So it's like all your releases are on Saturday. How is this possible? So yeah, today we had a chain axe of some kind. We've seen a trophy rack of spikes with skulls on it. We've seen a monstrous paw. We've seen a heavy bolter. All really cool stuff. Nothing really definitive in terms of, okay, what are we going to see other than a whole lot of Chaos Space Marines?
I mean, what do you expect? It's going to be new Chaos Space Marines. That's exactly what you're going to see bits of.
Yeah, I guess what I was looking at is when they show the picture, you know, there's the, I already blanked on his name, but the new sorcerer character that's supposed to be good at demonic possession. And then they have the new obliterator next to him. And then they have what looks like a new possessed. I don't know what that thing is. He's kind of got like the more organic carapace type thing. And the kind of a skull head. I was like, okay, what's he do? And so there's a lot of speculation on what that could be. So just curious what else is in there.
Yeah. So if we want to talk about that real quick, there are quite a few models in the Chaos Space Marine line that are quite old. Not even looking at characters. We've got the base Chaos Space Marine. There are two cult units left that are still old. You got the Noise Marines and then the Khorne Berserkers. I do believe the Possessed are somewhat old.
They're pretty old. They've kind of stood up for quite some time. It's just, I think the hardest part about them is the stat line has always been terrible.
Yeah. I would say of the older stuff, the Possessed are probably have probably held up the most. The least would go to the Khorne Berserker as far as the model itself goes.
You don't like figure skating Chaos Space Marines?
My biggest problem is the backpacks they come with don't even actually fit without you cutting a lot.
Better detail.
And then, of course, there's the vehicles. The Defiler is probably one of the least fun models to really deal with. You got to glue the legs in place, otherwise it's going to fall over every time. And even then, it might still fall over.
The problem I've had with the Defiler, especially now, because if you notice, even the new orc buggies are on bases.
Yeah.
And the Defiler being a close combat, you know, function, it has to have some shooting ability as well with that battle cannon. It was always like, okay, where do I touch? Do the legs count? Does the hull count?
Yeah.
And especially after the Soul Grinder came out, I was like, oh, that looks so much better.
I don't think we're going to see a replacement for the Defiler. I don't think we're going to see it continue on for very long because we're seeing new demon engines that look better. They'll probably work better on the table too. There's the Mutilator and Obliterator. Of course, we've already seen the new Obliterator. And I don't see them making Obliterators in plastic without them making them a multi-kit that can also make Mutilators. Because they're essentially the same thing. The difference is melee or shooting.
I could see that. I mean, it makes sense. I'm not denying that. I'm just kind of like, wow, Mutilators have been bad for so long.
Yeah. But another thing is we're getting new models. We might see whole new stat lines and rules.
I'm less inclined we'll see new data slates, but I do think that book will be chock full of these specialist attachments.
But we could still see new data slates. I mean, they did new data, didn't they do new data slates when it came to the Fiend and the Warhound?
And the Blood Crusher.
Yeah. So
they were significant. I mean, the Blood Crusher went up a wound, and I believe the Fiend went up a wound as well.
Yeah, and then they got new abilities. So it stands to reason that this could be where we see a change in the Chaos in some of these models, is they'll put it in that box set, and then we'll see like an FAQ for the codexes that basically say follow what's in that book.
Either way, 8 days, 8.5 days, whatever, cannot come soon enough. Very excited about this. So some really cool stuff. But then I guess the big thing I got question is what's next? They really haven't previewed a whole lot for specifically for 40K after that. And it seems like it's almost like this giant cliff of what's coming next is, I mean, obviously we have the big FAQ in the spring. That's usually right around Adepticon, so that's only about 5 weeks away. But, you know, a true new release, what's next? I have no idea.
So I think after this stuff, we're probably going to see 3 or 4 weeks of Chaos Space Marines, if it is as large as I think it's going to be. After that, I think is when we might see the new Slaanesh stuff, and it'll work because it'll go for both 40K and AOS. Now, when it came to AOS, they announced they were going to do a Chaos Army this year. And we've already, if memory serves, at that time they had already announced the new Skaven book. So that only leaves 4 more, unless they decide to add in a whole new one.
I was just surprised they added the Skaven book and the Beastmen book, because I was on the impression, and there's no fact behind this, so maybe it's just, I was just an error. The whole point of Age of Sigmar was to reinvent every army. So when I saw those 2 books come out, I was like, oh, I guess we're just going to reintroduce the old models. But then again, the Skaven got a pretty big update right before Fantasy got blown up, correct?
So everything, from what I understand, everything that was made up to 8th edition, they intend to keep, at least for a good while. The Tomb Kings, they decided to get rid of just because it was too setting specific. They didn't feel like they could really step away from the whole ancient Egypt look and still keep the army relevant. But outside of that, they have not gotten rid of anything. They have found creative ways to put some units into different armies, but they have not actually dropped anything that was made in 8th edition.
Right. Okay.
In fact, they actually kept Bretonnia. People don't realize it, but they kept Bretonnia. If you want to play Bretonnia in Age of Sigmar, you're playing the Flesh Eater Courts. I know it sounds strange, but if you actually read the Battle Tome, you'll see it too.
I saw something to that effect that basically, yeah, they died and then they're still alive as vampires. I was like, okay, that's insulting. Well,
Flesh Eater Courts aren't vampires. They're ghouls.
They're grotesque.
They're mad. They are cannibals who have gone so insane that they have full-on delusions that are so strong they can affect the sane people around them.
Well, all I know is they make great grotesque conversions, and they were quite handy. So
they do, don't they?
So I guess that's where I'm stuck on, is when when you see stuff like as much as cool as the Ambot is, and I think last week we talked about the Squat from Necromunda, I'm just thinking like, okay, somewhere there was something else on the 40K line just got pushed to the back of the row for production.
So I don't think that's the case.
Okay, so that's just my thought. They have only so many hours in the day, so many molds that they can make, and somehow, you know, the day of a plastic aspect warrior just got pushed back.
So we know that from, I don't remember who said it, but I think it might have been Reese, but there is a 9-month window for the books. So from the day that they decide that they're going to put out the book and it's done to the day it gets sent out to be purchased, there's 9 months. For them to be prepared for the models, it's further. That's why anytime you see copyright stamp in a sprue, it's never the year it came out. It's usually 2 years prior. Because they need that much longer to be prepared. They have to have a large supply already, you know, molded, packaged, and shrink-wrapped and ready to go. So they need 1-2 years already to have it. In fact, I was listening to, I think it was Voxcast, the GW 40K podcast, that they don't build models around the rules. They build rules around the models that get made.
Interesting. All right. Well, we will see what comes down the pike. Keep you guys updated as we find more information. In the meantime, we will take a quick break and we will go into this week's GT tournaments right after the break.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
Okay, welcome back. After the break, we start off in Cherrybrook, New South Wales, down in Australia, for Clash of the Titans 40K. You have to say it that way. By the way, I love their description, so if you log on to them on the BCP app, it just says, description, a good 40K event. I don't think we need to know anything more. So let's go over the top eight. So the top eight for the Clash of the Titans is starts off with an eighth place, Ian Andrew with Astra Militarum. Seventh place, Hayden Ford with Imperial Knights. Sixth place, David Tiho with Death Guard. Fifth place, Andrew Gerard with Aletak. Fourth place, Lee Abbey with Tau Empire. Third place, Lee Connor with Astra Militarum. Second place, Chris Dong with Imperial Knights. And the winner of the Clash of the Titans is none other than Christopher Wright with Death Watch. So congratulations to all our winners. And as asked by you guys, the listeners, let's talk a little bit about the Wooden Spoon. And he's perfectly named for it because it's none other than Patrick Spooner. He went a perfect 0-5, amassing 57 points with a Cult Mechanicus list. And I'm no expert at Cult Mechanicus, but a quick look at it, he's got a pretty decent list. So I guess he just maybe ran into a buzzsaw or just wasn't his weekend. So good luck. But Patrick Spooner, you are the Wooden Spoon recipient at the Clash of the Titans. Congratulations. The other big event over the weekend is, it's funny to be excited about a big event this early in the season, but it's very interesting is because the winners, some of the top eight players from the Berry Bash last year, that would be the sixth annual Berry Bash, held on to that and were able to parlay those points into a top 10 ITC season standings going into LVO. So without further ado, this year's seventh Berry Bash featuring six rounds as starts something off like this. In eighth place is Jeff Osborne with Necrons. Seventh place was Will Paul with Cult Mechanicus. Sixth place, Jason Sparks with the Suriani. Fifth place, Jeff Brown with Imperial Knights. Fourth place, Jim Vessel with Chaos Demons. Third place, Devin Swan. Yep, we've talked about him several times on the podcast. With, surprise, surprise, his famous Tau Empire. And here it is. The Codex has just been out. It came in second at a GT or a major. So therefore, it must be broken. We need a new Codex. It's Dustin Henshaw with Gene Stealer Cult. But the winner is a frequently named person here on the program, featuring Chaos Demons. The winner of the 7th Annual Barry Bash is none other than TJ Lanigan with Chaos Demons. So he's the only person to go complete undefeated 6-0. Quick looking at his list. No points for originality. Sorry, DJ, but we got a lot of good stuff here. He starts off with a Chaos Undivided Battalion featuring Changecaster, Poxbring, and the Sloppity Bile Piper, which I never get tired of saying, by the way. He's got a blob of 30 horrors and then two blobs of 28 plague bearers. I take that back. He's actually got 30. He's got the icon and the instrument as well. He backs it up with a Supreme Command Detachment, 1,000 Sons. Say it with me now, with Armon and two Demon Princes. And then he rounds that out with, this is where it gets a little bit different, but our co-host Don would disagree. Vanguard Detachment featuring another Demon Prince and then a unit of 6 Blight Lord Terminators and two Foul Spawns. So pretty simple.
It did not take long for those Death Guard Terminators.
Yeah, imagine that, huh? So who says, you know, we all craft our own armies in our own little cubicles? Nope, there they are. Looking at second place, this is what everybody's talking about, is the Gene Stealer Cult. This is their first foray since the Codex has dropped. Take a quick look at this list. He starts off with a battalion of Gene Stealer Cults. And he is the Cult Creed, the Twisted Helix. I don't remember that one. Which one is that, Ray? Twisted Helix. Forgot what they do. I've looked that one up. While he's looking that up, he's also brought in the Specialist Attachment, which is the Deliverance Brood Burge. So if you hear banjo music, it's just the Gene Stealers. HQs, he's got an Abominant. God, I hate those things. Those things are so hard to kill. You're like, I'm going to kill it. No, that's a character. You can't shoot at it yet. Oh, no. Oh, by the way, Heroic Intervention. I smash your skull in with a stop sign. Not that I'm speaking from experience. Anyway, an Abominant and a Primus. He's got three units of Acolyte Hybrids, one with 10 Hand Flamers, the other two with 4 Rock Saws. Second, in the elite slot, he's got a unit of 5 Aberrants. And then he brings in a brigade of Gene Stealer Cults. This one has to be Cult Creed, the Rusted Claw. He's got the Jackal Alphys, which is the motorcycle guy with the sniper rifle. He's got a Magus and a Patriarch. He's got 6 squads of Neophyte Hybrids. A Keller Morph, which Ray has actually on his desk because we're recording. A Locus and a Sanctus. And then he's got 3 units of 5 of the Jackals, which are the motorcycle guys. 3 units of Brood Brothers with heavy mortars, with, surprise, surprise, mortars. And then he finally rounds it out with another patrol of Gene Stealer Cults. And does not specify which cult he's with, but he has another Magus and another unit of Acolyte Hybrids. Interesting.
So, you said it was Twisted Helix,
yes,
and Rusted Claw? Twisted Helix is add 1 to the strength characteristic of models with this cult creed. In addition, add 2 to advance rolls for a unit with this cult creed.
All right, no surprise that all the guys with the rock saws are part of that group. Okay.
The Rusted Claws, when making saving throws, excluding invuln saves for a model with this cult creed, add 1 to the result. If the weapon being used to make the attack has an armor penetration characteristic of 0 or minus 1. In addition, biker models with this cult creed do not suffer the penalty to their hit rolls for moving and shooting heavy weapons or for advancing and shooting assault weapons.
So no surprise, that's the brigade with the 3 units of 5 bikers or fall into that category. Okay, wow. Very handy, well thought through. So, obviously done really well. It's coming in second place. Our third place finisher is Devin Spawn. Spawn. That's funny. Devin Swan. Sorry, Devin. You're not a chaos creature. But he is playing Tau, so we can't really trust him. Anyway, he starts off with a battalion. Sakea. I can never pronounce this correctly. I really like this faction, but I can never get to say it right. He's got two Cadre Fireblades and three unit of five Fire Warriors with Marker Lights. Then follows it up with a Tau Sept Vanguard featuring two, what's it got here? Commander and Enforcer suit, followed by a Riptide, and three Firesight Marksmen. Then finally another Tau Sept, this time a Spearhead Detachment featuring an Ethereal, two units of 10 Shield Drones, a unit of three Broadsides with high yield missile pods is what I'm trying to say, and three units of nine Sniper Drones. Ow. That's not very nice. It's one of those things at first, I kind of look at that list and I go, maybe he's going to have some trouble with board control, but Tau have trouble with board control anyway. So I think he just kind of doubles down on what Tau do well, and that's blowing you off the table. Anyway, I would be remiss if we did not discuss the winner of the Wooden Spoon for the Berry Bash, other than Dave Kachuk, featuring Chaos Demons. And looking at his list, he's got your pretty typical demon list. He's got the corned battalion, or patrol, rather, with a large unit of three bloodletters and a bloodmaster with the Crimson Crown to give them extra attacks on his rolls of six to wound. He's got a truckload of Nurgle, Lords of Change, got a wild mess of horrors and plague bearers and all kinds of mess. He's got a soul grinder, which is pretty cool. The only thing I thought was a little odd was his final detachment. Kind of went in a Z-ish direction, but not the usual Supreme Command detachment. So, but nice to see the Burning Chariot making the tabletop. Haven't seen those in quite some time. Honestly, I can't tell you what they do in this edition, so I'm not really sure how he would use those. So I have to do some research on those.
I think it's interesting that the person who won the Wooden Spoon and the person who won the whole thing both brought primary Chaos Demons. Yep.
I agree. Because when you look at that later and somebody like aggregates all the data, people are like, demons went, 6-6. Well, one of them won the tournament. One of them got, ripped apart. So is it the list?
And that's how you get a 50% win score.
Anyway, congratulations to all our winners. After the break, Ray and I have an interesting discussion, something that may or may not be coming to 40K. So I wanted to get your guys' opinions. Ray and I have experience with this type of format in previous games. And so we'll talk about that right after the break. All right, welcome back. So every now and then, when I don't get to play 40K, people ask, well, what are you doing? Because all my other friends seem to play 40K every weekend. I get stuck doing the fun stuff, like going to kids' birthday parties. And sometimes you get lucky. Like the last birthday party I went to, I met a guy who was really into cosplay and turned me on to all kinds of new materials I can use for terrain, some of which I'll be using for this weekend's Scorched Earth Open. So very excited about trying out some new material. Sometimes you run into some people that are just like, oh, okay. And but this was interesting. A friend of my son's, his dad is actually a soccer referee, and not just the fat guy who blows the whistle and stands against the post all the time. He's actually worked his way up the rankings. So he was actually invited to Russia for the World Cup and had to work his way up. So there's all kinds of scrutiny and how well he refereed the game. If you blinked, you probably missed him. He was a sideline judge for one of the qualifier games and a replay judge for two other games. But nonetheless, it's pretty cool talking to a guy who was on the field for a World Cup game in a foreign country. I thought that was pretty cool. So it got me thinking, 40K is trying to position themselves as being the next sport, whether it be an e-sport or a tabletop sport or how you want to call it. And I was like, well, he was asking me, if you run those events, what kind of criteria do you have? And I kind of went, it's the Wild West. It really is the Wild West. And interesting enough, that was one of the things that's very attractive about the ITC format. But Ray, you've had experience in other game systems where they have a little bit of a criteria. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'm sure I've mentioned it in one of the past episodes, is that before I started playing this, I tried my hands at Magic, including toying with the idea of going into the big tournaments. Now, I learned a few things just from going to the local FNM, because, well, it's a lot of the rules that they have going into the big tournaments are implemented at the Friday Night Magic level. And, of course, there are enough people there who did the large tournaments that the Friday Night Magic was very competitive. So, that being said, Magic the Gathering in their tournaments have judges. But these judges don't just walk up and say, I'm going to judge a tournament, and then they're given everything and said, well, have fun. That's not how they do it. What they do is they do a bit of a kind of an accreditation program where they like take a test to prove that they actually know the rules, and given the responsibility of running, you know, a certain amount of tournaments on a yearly basis. And then, of course, every so often they need to renew it. And they would do a, I'm sure they still do, but they do a kind of a leveling system where, you know, this person may be a level 1 and can do an FNM, but another person might be a level 3 and can do up to a Pro Tour qualifier. And at every level, of course, there's more tests, more commitment. And one of the things that's nice about that is it makes the judging a little bit more standardized. You know, a lot of times nowadays, if it's not in the FAQ or the Codex, one tournament may say, do it this way, but the, you know, the GT you go to 3 weeks down the road, the next state over, will have a completely different ruling. Now, if you do something like this where it's accreditation, that means these judges are working together. So, let's say you have a ruling at that RTT. Well, after that, the judge is probably going to be smart about it and present his judgment on that kind of a ruling to the others that are within the group and give his point of view, and they can go from there. It may work its way all the way up to GW and find its way into the next FAQ, or it may just be held at the tournament scale and it eventually finding its own official ruling. So yes, it may end up, you know, a couple weeks down the road at that GT become a different ruling, but by that time, you'll probably already know about it one way or another through some sort of an official announcement, or it will, you know, you'll find out about it, and then that will become the consistent ruling, because at that point it's been the ruling or the new ruling gets dispersed throughout all the judges.
So I had a different experience with this, and that's where I was kind of went, a knee-jerk reaction to asking about this. So way back when, in a very dark time, this was pre-internet, so this was a while ago, I used to be on a con planning committee, and we all kind of helped out. So you couldn't just run your favorite game and say, hey, look, I helped out. Everybody had to do a little bit in the registration area. And one of the areas I pitched in on was not only the miniatures room, but also the role-playing room. And I'll be honest, I'd say 80% of our ticket sales came from role-playing events, specifically the LARP that was run overnight, which I don't get, but hey, it was a learning experience. So one of the things that was real popular at the time was the living campaigns from part of the RPGA network, which means if we wanted to run those events, as the tournament organizer, not only did I have to buy the packets and the adventures, but I had to find a certified dungeon master that had the right levels to write the right events that we had chosen. And it was a nightmare. It was one of those things where we did extensive polling of our, you know, attendees. What adventures do you want to see at this event? One of the game masters was like, yeah, I'm not going to run that adventure. I hate that one. So done. One off the list. Okay. We need four because we have so many people coming. All right. One of them was a prima donna. He demanded ridiculous amounts of compensation to attend the event beyond a free ticket. Okay. We will think twice about that, but we'll figure out what we can do. And of course, one of them who did agree and was asking all kinds of questions, was super supportive, blew off the event. So eventually it just became a process of, okay, who are the role players on the planning committee? And then the next year they became RPG level people, but obviously they didn't have the pedigree or the sort of looking for the advanced levels like you described, because they're basically doing it for a once a year event. So it was one of those kind of mixed levels of like, all right, how do we make this work? And I don't know. I don't know if I want to get to that point with 40K. And I admit I've got a big dog in the fight, and you know, I've got my large event this weekend. You know, Don and I combined run about 4 to 8 events every year. And now, which is a big time commitment, big monetary commitment. And now I'm being, it could be down the road, you need to get a certification type thing. Okay, I'm not a good test taker. What happens if I fail? What happens that? What happens if somebody runs an event that's not certified? So I don't know, Ray, if you've had experience of that with the other game systems, what happens in those situations?
So I never came up to an experience where they didn't have someone. You see, at the stores, at least at the one I went to, they had one person who would often work Friday nights, and part of his responsibility became being a judge. So the store always had a judge. In fact, over time, because of the amount of tournament level players were there, much of them just decided to take it. And then some of them took different levels so that they could run whatever events that they could. You know, they weren't restricted to just the Friday nights. They were eventually able to, you know, run a PTQ or events like that, because for whatever reason, you have to do a qualifier for, you know, a Pro Tour game. But the point is the stores found a way to accommodate. Now, in a game like 40K, the stores don't always support tournaments. And, you know, that's on them. But if they choose to, they may, you know, talk to one of the people who frequent the store and already know well enough about the game that, you know, they might already be going to tournaments. So, you know, let's use this for an example. You, Eric, go to a store every Friday. You're there like clockwork. You get 1-2 games in and you go to tournaments. Well, that store manager may come up to you and say, I'd like to have you run, you know, one tournament every 4 months here, and I'd be more than willing to work around the tournaments that you want to actually play in if you will take the accreditation test and become a judge for my tournaments. Now, they shouldn't be making you pay for doing the taking the test. But, of course, being a judge will take a portion of your time. So, you know, let's say you decide to do this. You take the test, you become that judge. Or maybe somebody else does. But, you know, just once you have that, you know, once you have the ability to be the judge at that store, you're not restricted to just doing it at that store.
No, I agree. I mean, that was one of my, right after college, I made a ton of money because I was a lifeguard, and like Boy Scout trips, they'll go on like canoeing trips or swimming events. Having a private lifeguard for their troop was good money for me. So I was like, sweet, this is kind of nice. So yeah, I get the idea I could pimp myself out to other stores. And I guess where I'm looking at is, you know, what is this accreditation? How would it be set up? What's involved? What are the costs? And how is it monitored? You know, it's one of those things where I'm like talking to this guy who was a, you know, FIFA referee. That's pretty stringent. And, you know, in terms of what the criteria was and how close they were going. And, you know, it's one of those, you know, intentions are there. Obviously, when I run an event, is my intention to run the best event possible. It's not like I'm purposely making bad calls, but I definitely make mistakes. And that's something where, like, I would hate to let the store down in that situation where, like, okay, dude, last tournament, you made a bad call. So you may lose your accreditation for the next 6 months. I'm like, oh, what? So.
I don't think it would be like that personally. It would now how things were done would ultimately depend on who decided to do the program. If it was ITC or the people who run Adepticon or GW itself, even. So they pick out who they'll pick how they're going to do it. Most likely it's just going to be your basic test that is ultimately going to work off of the rules themselves. So if you know the rules, and it's not going to be, you know, like take like a driving test where they pick, you know, really tricky words and things like that. It's going to be like, it'll probably be something along the lines of, well, here, let me give an example. And this is going to sound strange. A lot of people might be aware of the card game for AOS that came out a while back. And it's still going from what I understand. It hasn't really picked up here in Arizona, but, Age of Sigmar Champions. I actually took the test to where if I wanted to, I could judge. Now, the test itself had everything to do with rules and how they would work when they were, you know, combined. Now, you weren't expected to know the rules off the top of your head. You're allowed to look at the cards and read the cards. So it's almost like an open book test. Eric, do you think you could take a test about 40K if you were allowed to look at the rule
book? Honestly, I didn't do so well with the pub crawl quizzes, but I think I could be able to get through it.
Yeah. So that would be it. The hardest thing to do would be to, you know, answer a question that has never been posed. Now, if that's the case, you can't give the wrong answer. Now, ultimately, you can give an answer that's going to be judged differently in the end. But if there's no precedent for it, that's not something that they're going to ding you for. Because the smart thing to do would be to say, okay, I want to do this ruling. And then after the tournament's over, get in touch with the other judges. Because I can't think that they would not have some sort of special forum, maybe a Facebook page, something where all these people could gather and discuss stuff like this. Anyway, you take that ruling that, you know, has never come up that in your experience, whether it be in person or in this group, and you say, hey, this just came up. I was not able to find anything, so this is what I suggested. Now, they may have a Google Doc where people can put everything down and keep track of it all. And the group of judges discuss the point, and you know, in the end, they may decide you made the right call, or they may say, you know, let's do this instead. And then that's what happens. You do that instead. You may never have to deal with that again. You may never have to deal with that rule issue again. But you're not dinged for it because they decided to, over at the end of the day, after the tournament, that, you know, your ruling wasn't the best one. Ultimately, you would be judged more by the rules that are already out. So let's say that you overhear an argument with someone playing Space Marines and their opponent is playing Gene Stealer Cult. The Space Marine player is arguing with the Gene Stealer Cult player because he's tried to play the stratagem that is like the Agents of Vect stratagem. He's playing it a second time because his codex doesn't, because there's nothing in the codex saying that he can't play it a second time. The Space Marine player says, no, you can only play that one time in a game. You're a judge. You already know a bunch of the rules, including FAQs and all this and that. You also have on your hand a tablet or something where you keep track of all the FAQs. You ask the Gene Stealer Cult player for his codex. You consult the stratagem. And maybe you already know it, maybe you don't. But in the FAQ that came out, well, today, on Monday, that they made it where that particular stratagem is one use per game. So you can make the ruling, and you can, you know, politely tell the Gene Stealer Cult player that he should probably download the FAQ that came out.
Which has actually happened in games. Yeah, that's happened. You know, so
that's really what you're
probably update doing. And I feel like kind of gotcha moment where they're like, oh, I didn't know that. So
yeah. And you know, something that I think would be pretty cool at some tournaments, especially something like a major, is maybe announce, hey, just a reminder, you may want to double check and see if the FAQ for your faction has been updated. Because like a month or two ago, there was a very small update to the Thousand Suns one that I wasn't even aware of until I just by accident decided to check. It was very minuscule, but it was a change. You know, people have to remember that, yes, there's the FAQ that happens, quote unquote, 2 weeks after the codex comes out, that really can be anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months. And then there's the big FAQ. Yeah, sure, there's going to be those too, but you need to keep track, you know, check once a month. Or if you're going to a tournament, check the night before just to see if it's a bit updated. Because it can't hurt. But of course, we're talking about judging. So it's important for the judge to, I don't expect any judge to know the FAQs by heart. But I would hope that he would carry around a copy just so that he can consult it if he needs to.
Well, that is the plan. So make sure you have those materials available to you. I guess where I'm stuck on is, you know, you mentioned a lot of the resources working together. There is already a Facebook group. Group with that to, you know, I guess the idea of the consistency, I understand that holding everybody up to date, some accountability, it's never goes, you know, it's never a bad thing. I think it's more the how than the why is where I'm stuck on, you know, if this were something that would come to pass. So
the how, the how is a little bit more complicated in the actual implementation of the test itself, but I think the smart thing to do would be for them to have an online sign up. You know, you give your name. They'll probably want your birth date for make sure, you know, you're 18 or older. They may ask, you know, questions that way that they can have an idea of, you know, maybe the state, what country and or state you live in, because they're not going to want 500 judges in Arizona and zero in the entire Southeast. They're probably going to want to have some sort of a sweet spot. You know, like the Phoenix area is big. You may want to have somewhere between 3 and 5, ideally. Someplace like Rhode Island might only need one. They probably, but they won't have minimums. They'll probably have, you know, caps. You know, like we don't, you don't need, you know, 30 judges that go to, that all run, can't only run RTTs going to the Games Workshop store two streets down in San Diego. But ultimately it would be, take a test on this website, give us your basic information. And then after that, it's probably something as simple as run X tournaments a year, one or two, maybe a little bit more. I don't know. RTTs are kind of iffy. They may want 3, they may want 4, but what you do then is, I'm assuming they probably do everything through best coast pairings at the point of the tournaments. And what you do is, the judge would probably be responsible for creating the tournament on best coast pairings. And they would probably have a spot where you would have to put in a judge number. You know, it might be a 5. They may start right off the bat with some sort of a 5-digit code that you might even set up on your own. You know, you may be judge, you know, 37251. And when you create the tournament, you put that in and it automatically dings that you've run a tournament. And here is the tournament. You know, and depending on how many people show up, it might even go so far as to be able to say, well, you know, here's Eric judge number whatever, and he's run 2 RTTs and a GT. You know, so it might even be able to pull that kind of an aggregation out that it can distill it. It can, the computer software could determine what size, you know, tournaments you've been playing. You know what I'm saying?
Sorry, I thought you realized I had my mute not still on. So I was talking away. So no, I get the idea. Yeah, that makes a lot. I don't know. I guess it would be, we'll see how the why or the how this comes out. I think you're right. It may be a good, maybe just too much. I mean, I'll be honest, we're 4 days away from my big event. I got a little bit on my plate right now. So maybe the last thing I need to see is, yo, if you want to run that event, you're going to have to take a test. And I was like, what?
I think it would be important on something like this to allow for a period of time to get people to do the testing.
Right.
I think it's important to not just implement it. You know, you can't just be like, okay, this is what we're doing now. There's plenty of, you know, low-level tournament organizers who could only maybe do one a year. You know, here in the, you know, the west side of Phoenix, you and Don are the ones that tend to hold tournaments. Now, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to do that many, you know, 4 in a year. Now, because there's 2 of you, the two of you could more easily run 4 between the 2 of you than one could doing 4. So, I almost think that if they do something like this, then what they need to consider is not how many you run, but how many get run in the area. Now, we don't want judges who are, you don't necessarily want judges who are not actually running tournaments, so it might be a good idea to still want to have, you know,
right,
at least one event. So if the Phoenix area has 6 judges, it may be a requirement that each of you hold at least one. Now, that actually is helpful for the hobby because that means that 6 tournaments get done in a year instead of just 4. And each one of you has
spreads the wealth a little bit.
I don't think the problem is going to be how many events get run. I think the problem is just going to be determining the best way to go about making sure the judges judge. And I also think it'll be important that if they're going to do something like this, that, and I know this is probably going to be the most unpopular position I make. If you're judging, maybe you shouldn't be playing. Maybe you should actually focus on judging. I'm all for the judges being able to get to play. But there comes a point where you as a player are only judging and, or you're a judge and you're only playing. And neither of those are very fun extremes. If you're the player who only ever judges, I mean, you kind of get screwed out of getting games in other than testing on how rules work. If you're a judge who's playing games in your own, if it's in your own tournament, people don't really look at that as as a fair fight. You know, I can go back to Magic the Gathering here. Is that the people who judge, they'll play tournaments. You can have an event where there's 4 different events, smaller events going on all in one building at different times. If you're judging one, you're not playing in that one. You're playing in the others. I think that's an important thing to do if you're going to have some sort of an accredited judge program. I also think it would be important for the judges to be recognized in some way. Now, I don't know if they still do it, but in the past, Magic the Gathering would do something small for the judges. They would get promo cards, little things like that, you know. Now, I wouldn't expect the ITC or GW to, you know, give out kits, but they may still do something like artwork. You know, all the judges who judge GTs during the, let's say, just for the sake of it, let's say the 2020 ITC season, get an artwork of Sanguinius fighting Horus in new artwork. You only get this artwork if you're a judge in GT level events.
That would be pretty cool.
Something like that.
That would be kind of cool.
You know, it might cost them a little bit of money, but yeah. Yeah. Now, I know that the Games Workshop and Warhammer stores, when they reach certain goals, they'll get goodies. Down at the Warhammer store in Goodyear, they've got a really cool Nagash bit of artwork that's hung up, and that was a performance artwork that, for him having performed well during a certain period of time. You know, they may do something like that for judges. Now, I doubt it would be quite as special. It might be something a little bit more like some of those artworks that you see in the 2-player boxes, the 2-faction boxes. But it would still be something that would be special for the judges. And I'm sure the higher the judge, the more special it would be. You know, you might only see, you for something like an RTT level, you might see, you know, some special plastic objective markers. But someone who runs a major
seems might get his own primary lieutenant.
More and more every day. They're multiplying like rabbits. But, you know, my point stands. If you're going to do an accreditation program and you can't just let anybody be a judge, you have to, you know, you're making people do some sort of a test. it's important to recognize the people who decide to step up and say, I am willing to put myself out there and be the guy who does the testing, or does the testing and becomes a judge and judges events. Because what you're doing is you're committing yourself to the community, whether the community is willing to, you know, recognize that or not, the people who are doing the accreditation need to recognize that, you know, if it wasn't for the judges, there may not be as robust a community.
All right. So if you have any thoughts on an accreditation program for judges, hit us up on our Facebook page. You can see us on Exterminatus Podcast. After the break, we'll go over. We have the updated 2019 IDC Top 10, as well as upcoming events in the ITC. Be back right after the break.
Go ahead.
Great. Welcome back after the break, and we're at that fun part of the season where we go over the ITC Top 10, and there are a bunch of names you've never heard of. I'm just impressed these people have already gotten three tournaments under their belt since LVO started, so that's pretty impressive. So let's look at our current ITC Top 10. In 10th place, we have Chris Kentrup. 9th place, Naaman Allen. 8th place, Ivan Cho. 7th place, Simon Lean, which is pretty impressive considering he is playing Sisters of Battle. In 6th place, we have Derek Simon. 5th place, Jim Vessel. 4th place, XR Exodar. I'm sure that's his birth name. 3rd place, we have Richard Siegler. 2nd place, Michael Serapata. And your current leader of the ITC very early in the season is none other than Michael Ralston. Ray, what events do we have in the ITC coming up next weekend?
All right. So, starting from the top of the list off of Best Coast Pairings is the Scorched Earth Open in Glendale, Arizona.
Yay!
We've got the Cleansing of Orask in Karaskrona. War Games for Warriors in Sandy, Utah. There's the Dice Hammer Warhammer 40K GT2 in Lake Forest, California. The Desperate Allies GT in Conway, Arkansas. The CAG Bash 12 Part 2 of MAGS series in Hamilton, Ohio. The Warhammer 40K March Grand Slam GT in Liverpool, England. The Critical Hit Grand Slam GT in Liverpool, England. The Games of Westeros 6 in Vastmanland. The LWG Open Winter Warfare somewhere in England, wherever Dark Sphere Megastore is. All right, and that appears to be it. That is quite the list for one weekend.
That is quite the list. All right, good start to the ITC season. So next week, we will have wall-to-wall coverage of our event, the Scorched Earth Open. Hopefully get a good new look at some of the new meta. I know a lot of people have been blowing up my phone about armies based around the new Bolter beta rules, so see if that comes to fruition. In the interim, please hit us up on our Facebook page, as well as give us a review on iTunes. I haven't asked for that in a while. In the interim, my name's Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus Podcast.